Back to work. All right, now I really mean for these seven concepts to be kind of a piece, and so I'm going to try and go quickly. We'll finish here, and then tomorrow night we're going to go to the new covenant distinctives. But so let me just rehearse that what we're asking ourselves is, according to the Bible, how is it that God, what are the strategies by which he determined through Israel, the people, the nation of Israel, to put himself on display? And first of all, he was never abandoning the rest of the world. Israel was to be a light to the nations, but the way he did that was by placing Israel in the midst of the nations and then making them that choke point on the international highway. But in order for Israel to be a people unto themselves, that is a set-apart nation, he shaped the land. But now, number four is what I call the wisdom and will of God concerning the worship and the walk of Israel. I used to be quite taken with alliteration. When I would prepare a sermon, I'd spend about as much time in Roger's thesaurus as I would in the commentary. But anyway, I don't know. I was proud of that one. The wisdom and will of God concerning the worship, and what I'm talking about is the Mosaic Law. Now, let me. This is so important. Now, remember, I'm discussing this in the context of how it is that God was going to use Israel to be a light to the nation. And God gave them this remarkable law system. Now, you and I think you ought to work at this to correct this, because you and I have an intuitive distaste for the law. I mean, we're under grace and not law, and Paul beats up on the law and the people who look to the law and so on. And it's all too easy to get kind of a dismissive, if not contemptuous, attitude toward the law. As Paul says in four words, the law is good. Remember that? If men use it lawfully. And the word good, by the way, in the Bible kind of is the word. I mean, we use it for peanut butter or whatever, and that's all right. They probably did too. But in the Bible, it sums up all that is noble, all that God approves. And so, and the law is magisterial. Now, all right, what is the law? It is that set. All right, let's think about the giving of the law. So God, in fulfillment of a covenant he made to Abraham 600 years earlier, because now Israel's been in Egypt for 400 years, he brings them out powerfully. And he gets them to Mount Sinai, and he offers them this covenant by which he will be their king and they will be his people. They accept the covenant. I often think, there weren't a lot of choices. I mean, you know, here we are in this wilderness, and we got nothing to eat except the bread that falls out of the sky every morning. But nonetheless, they did submit to the covenant. I don't think happily. Like I say, most of them are lost. They're going to die in the wilderness. They're going to rebel again and again. But nonetheless, God offered them the covenant, Yahweh, and he became their king. It is the prerogative of the king. You know, it's the golden rule. He has the gold and makes the rules, right? No. But the king has the prerogative of making the laws, and that's what he does. It's interesting. Think about Exodus. Exodus, they come out of Egypt in the Exodus, they get to Mount Sinai, God offers them this covenant. In Exodus 24, remember what happens after God has made clear what the law would entail and so on, gives them this book of the covenant. But now Moses takes an animal and slays it, and he takes some of the blood and he sprinkles it on the people, as it were, probably on the elders, and then he cuts the covenant. The Mosaic covenant is cut. All right, the word covenant in the Old Testament is bereath. Are you familiar with this? Bereath means cutting. And it comes from that. We get the best illustration of this in Genesis 15, where Abraham is told to take those animals and cut them in two. And normally we get the idea sometimes, those people, where they were so primitive and they were just stumbling around and so on. They were so much more sophisticated, so much more intelligent. Not only that we give them credit for than we are, as far as I'm concerned. Now, we got different methods and so on, but they had careful legal methodologies and protocols. And when you made any sort of covenant treaty, sales contract, this you would often do. You would take an animal, you would cut it in two, and then the parties to the covenant would walk between those pieces in the presence of witnesses, and they would recite the terms of the covenant. If it's sales, they know it's this much property, this much company. And they would recite it, and the reason for that is, I think this is why it was called a blood covenant, and everybody would agree, but I'm convinced this only thing makes sense. What they were saying is, if I fail in my part of the covenant, then you do to me what we did to that animal. And so a covenant was a cutting, and God cut the covenant, that's Abraham, that's one of the times where God most formally, Genesis 15, cuts that Abrahamic covenant. Now you fast forward 600 years, Mount Sinai, and God's going to cut a covenant that we call the Sinaitic or the Mosaic covenant. And that covenant is when Moses sprinkles that blood. That's Exodus 24. Now, the first thing that happens in Exodus is that immediately after that, God calls Moses up into the mountain. Remember, the mountain is all aquake with fire and thunder and so on. Moses go up there 40 days, and of course, then you have the golden calf incident, but then Moses returns for another 40 days for a total of 80 days, during which, interestingly enough, he neither ate nor drank. Remember that? He evidently, that's what it is to subsist on fellowship with God, it seems to me. But at any rate, the point is that what's going on up there? God is giving Moses careful instruction as to how to build a what? A throne room. Now, we know it as the tabernacle, but it is first and foremost a throne room. They've accepted him as king. He needs a throne. That's the Ark of the Covenant. I probably told you before, if I talk about the Ark of the Covenant and you're thinking about a really big boat, you need to spend more time in the Old Testament. You know what I'm saying? But the fact is that that's his throne. And then, of course, the tabernacle itself is his throne room. And so now Moses goes down. First thing you got to do is you got to have a throne for your king. And so they gather the material, and God's enables these two guys, Aholiab and Bezalel, and they build a tabernacle and they set it up. And at the very end of Exodus, what happens? Here, why not? See if I can find it real quickly. Yeah. At the very end of Exodus, what happens is the glory cloud, which has been atop the Mount Sinai for all of this time, look at it right here. So Moses finished the work. What work? Setting up the throne room / tabernacle. And then what happened? The cloud covered the tabernacle of meeting. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. That is the enthronement of King Yahweh. He is taking his throne. And Moses wasn't able to enter the tabernacle of meeting because the cloud rested above and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And by the way, it goes on to say, interestingly enough, you remember this, whenever the cloud was taken up, the children of Israel would go onward. If the cloud was not taken up, they didn't journey. The cloud of the Lord was above the tabernacle. By the way, the cloud of the Lord was above the tabernacle by day and fire was over by night. There were not two clouds. It was a pillar of fire. Again and again, in the Old Testament, when God reveals himself physically, we call it a theophany, there is brilliant fire. Remember the fourth person in the furnace, I believe, is the angel of the Lord. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar looks in and he says, one of those, I only threw in three and there are four in there, and one of them is like unto a god. What was it about that personage? I think he was brilliant. So in the midst of a flame that was heated seven times hotter than normally, there was a blinding light that was the. So again and again, that's what you have where God appears, and that's what's going on here. You have this glory cloud, but it's so bright it would burn the retina. Haven't you seen Indiana Jones? I guess it burned the flesh on it, we won't go there. But the point is that you couldn't, and so it was engulfed in a cloud. And so by day, it looked like a cloud that glowed brightly. By night, you didn't see the clouds, you just saw the fires. That makes sense to you? But it's interesting here at the end of Exodus, when the cloud, what's it saying? It's saying God is physically in charge. He gives the marching orders. When he goes up, it's to that degree that God is really the king. All right, the king's going to, what happens next? All right, let's go to Leviticus. Here it is. The Lord called to Moses and spoke from the tabernacle meeting and says, speak to the children. And he begins, and Moses goes up. Now, I don't know if he goes up, but because now the glory cloud so is in the tabernacle. But at any rate, I think Moses got himself a seat and got a really good case of writer's cramp. You know what I'm saying? Because King Yahweh begins to dictate the law. Now, half of the first five books of Moses is law. And when I say law, it's statutes, it's regulations, it's ordinances, it's codes about every conceivable area of life. And you have, beginning in Exodus 21, you have Really? I mean, you have the adventure of the golden calf, and then you have the setting up of the tabernacle, but it's the law, because God had to describe exactly how that tabernacle was built, how big it was, what material and so on. All of that's laid out. This is how you're to build it. And then, of course, God, King Yahweh, enters the tabernacle, takes his throne, and he resumes. And so all of Leviticus. I always say, remember when you were doing your reading through? Oh, I'm going to do it. Genesis was a great time, and Exodus, you were moving right along, got a little slow there, but then you hit Leviticus, and you thought, what did I sign up for heaven's sakes? You know, how much do I want to know about the fat underneath the tail of the ram? You know what I'm saying? But it's hugely important. That's why I say it's so important. But the point is that all of Leviticus and then the first 10 chapters of Numbers are this scene right here. God, King Yahweh is dictating to Moses the law. And then what happens is, in Numbers chapter 10, they break camp, and you have the wilderness wanderings, and finally they get to, the old generation dies, and they get to the border of the promised land, and God gives a second, Deuteronomy. What does that mean? Second law. So he, once again, lays out the law with specific application, what it's going to be like when you get into the land. So half of Exodus, all of Leviticus, 10 chapters of Numbers, and virtually all of Deuteronomy is law. And it touches every area of life. Religiously, exactly how you're to worship, when you're to worship, what you're to bring, what the priests have to be. Morally, although, and I don't like to break it down this way as if they're three distinct, but there are types of statutes. Morally, as far as what's actually right and wrong, it's pretty much the Ten Commandments. That's pretty much the whole boatload when it comes to just explicit moral realities. Now, he enlarges on that in a lot of passages. And then the other big section is civil law, tort law. You have to build, the law says, if you build a house, you have to, and you have a roof. Every house that Israel, in that culture, you always used your roof as a living space. And so they said you have to battlement around so somebody doesn't fall off. If your ox gets loose and rips up your neighbor's garden, you got to pay for the garden. There are parts of the law that are a little pedantic, and you know, just that. And there are other parts that are, you know, don't come up in junior church, if you know what I'm saying. For instance, you're scared of what I'm going to say about it. But I always say, if you want to know how to build a latrine, that's the place to go. I mean, to tell you, it's laid out very specifically. Because when soldiers go to battle, you know, disease is more deadly in most cases than the battle. And so God explained exactly how it was. So the law touches every area of life. And all right, so what's that all about? The point is, one of the great theological conundrums, shouldn't be, I can make it so easy for you. But one of the great theological questions and debates and so on, how does the law apply to me today? Here's Bookman's answer. You can check with Kevin and David later, but here's Bookman's answer. It doesn't. It has no application to you. Not application. It doesn't. There's no, you are not under the law in any sense, to any degree. Because what is the law? It is that set of statutory regulations by which King Yahweh determined to order his kingdom. Now, there are things you can learn, and I love the law, and I think there is so much to learn. But understand, that's what's going on. You know what? We're back to kind of what I started out with, and that is the tendency is to make everything about us and salvation. So what's the law? Well, you know, the law is designed to teach us that we're lost. Well, it certainly has that effect if you get very close to it, but is that what it was designed to do? Can you go exegetically and say, no, what it was, this is King Yahweh, newly enthroned, laying down that set of regulations by which he is going to administer his kingdom. Does that make sense to you? All right, now, what's that got to do with us? Well, let me take you back. Did you see that up there? It did. How come it worked today and it didn't work yesterday? Now, here's the point. So you have this marvelous law system. And the fact is, I say here, that law code was intended by God to be the means by which individuals could draw near to God. To be sure, it included the Levitical, temple restrictions and so on. But here it is, by which Israel would be kept distinct from the nations. We had that before, so many of those that would make. But the other thing is that allegiance to that law code, personal and national allegiance, was the means by which God intended that Israel would be a powerful testimony. Here's the point. And it's explicit in Deuteronomy 4, and I think we should go there because it's such an important passage. You know, nothing defines and, well, I guess I can leave it at that. Nothing defines a people, a nation, more than its laws. Now think about what that means to the culture in which we live. But the system of morality and justice which you as a people embrace is going to define who you are. The law that God gave, that King Yahweh gave, is magisterial in its justice, in its equity, in its compassion, in its wisdom, and totally godless, unbelieving philosophers have acknowledged. I'm thinking of Aldous Huxley, who has a quote in Maclean's Greatness of the Kingdom book, that if any people actually ever determined to actually live by the law, it would be the most delightful, just people on the face of the earth. And Moses says that, and I want you to hear that, because we're asking ourselves, how did God contrive in the Old Testament to make himself known to the rest of the world beyond Israel? And I'm saying that he placed Israel there in the land, and he made sure that those stories would be heard, and he shaped the land, but then he gave them this law. And here's what he says. This is Moses on the plains of Moab. He's about to die. But he says, surely I have taught you statutes and judgment, just as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should act according to them in the land which you go to possess. Now listen to this. Therefore, be careful to observe them, for this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, all the nations around, who will hear all these statutes. And they will say, surely, this nation, this great nation, is a wise and understanding people. And then he says, this is Moses speaking, for what great nation is there that has God so near to it as Yahweh our God is to us for whatever reason we may call upon him? And here it is, what great nation is there that has such statutes and righteous judgments as are in all this law which I set before this day? I'm telling you, folks, and I could spend a long time, but I don't have a long time. We're going to be done in just a few minutes. But just real quickly, for instance, obviously, and it kind of, you know, disturbs you and breaks your heart a little bit to think about this reality given where we live today, but nothing about the law system, I think, is more pivotal, more important than the way you determine guilt or innocence in a court of law. The way you handle criminal accusations. You're going to have criminals, and if you don't have an effective system of determining and guilt and innocence and then punishment and so on, well, there are two basic legal protocols in the law which absolutely characterize and civilize and make equitable the law system if they're honored. You know what I'm talking about? The first one, the one you're familiar with, is in the mouth of two or three witnesses will every matter be established. Now that's a jurisprudential indeed canon. In the mouth of two or three. Why did our forefathers insinuate that Fifth Amendment that a person cannot be forced to testify against himself? Because they understood that can be corrupted, and they understood that the biblical standard is guilt can only be established in the mouth of at least two and better three eyewitnesses. Folks, if you honor that, that changes. It doesn't mean that your law system is going to be absolutely perfect and it's never going to be, you know, there's not going to be any miscarriage. It might happen. But I'll tell you what, if you allow that, it's a without which not. If you don't honor that, then your law system is going to be totally corrupt. But the second one that's much overlooked, is known as lex talionis. And this is hugely misunderstood and underappreciated. You know what lex talionis is? The law of the talon? An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And when we read that, it sounds kind of like vigilante or something. Oh, no. It was always understood, and this is what God meant to understand. What that meant, that the idea is that, number one, the punishment must fit the crime. There has to be a correspondence. Now, it's interesting in this regard. There was a Babylonish, early Babylonish, what we call Old Babylon. You know, you've heard of the Code of Hammurabi. Maybe you've heard of that. But that was a Babylonish king, and he had a law code, and it came down to us. It's been preserved. And he was basically contemporary, just a little early from Moses. So it's about the same time. In the Code of Hammurabi, if I steal from you, I repay, and I'm found guilty, I have to repay fourfold. If I steal from the king, then my hand is chopped off. Now, what's happened there is that the law has become a means of social engineering. You're trying to make the point that the king is a lot more important than the common man. That's not justice. It's simply not justice. Stealing is stealing, does that make sense to you? Now, by the same token, the way the Jews have always understood this, I think the way God intended to understand it, lex talionis, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is simply this, that it is the perpetrator who pays the penalty. You do the crime, you do the time, right? And that's how they understood it. Now, interestingly enough, in that same Code of Hammurabi, if I build you a house and a beam falls down, it's explicit, and kills your daughter, you kill my daughter. That's barbaric. That's not justice. She didn't do anything. So you take those principles that, number one, you're only going to be, and of course you can't, it was absolutely clear, you can't punish a person until he has been proven guilty, and you can only prove guilty in the mouth of two or three eyewitnesses, and the punishment must fit the crime, and only the person who did the crime does the time. That's unspeakably civilizing of a judicial system. That's right out of the law. It was explicit in the law. I was going to say light years, but it was of a different moral order than all the other law codes that we have any access to. Another area is widows. In ancient cultures, widowhood was more disastrous than you can imagine. For this reason, generally, remember I told you before, I think, I don't know if I ever did it here, but in the Bible we're talking about clans, right? Extended families. And generally with time, if this is a clan and this is a clan and there's a young man here and there's a young woman there and they want to marry, the young man's going to find a wife in a different clan. Many, many cases. All right, now, say that this young man takes a wife from this clan and they move on, whatever, and a little time goes by and she dies. I'm sorry, he dies. So her husband dies. All right, so let's just say for purposes of an illustration, that man who died had five brothers. So, before he died, they each anticipated, I'll leave out the double portion here for just a minute for ease, but they each anticipated when their father died, they'd get 1/6. Ah, now they're going to get 1/5 if they can get rid of that woman. And so she's going to be rejected. And the word widow in the Greek means destitute one. Because in those cultures, there was no provision whatever. She was just going to be rejected. And she's probably going to have to turn to prostitution or whatever. Not in the law. In the law, there is this statute that we kind of stumble over, but it is bottomlessly wise and gracious, called the law of levirate marriage. Now, levirate simply means, it's not a Hebrew term, it doesn't mean Levi, it means a Latin term, and it means brother-in-law. And if a woman is in that position, then one of those brothers is required to go into her and to raise up seed. And there's a famous court case in Numbers where where it was the issue was, well, when the father dies, does that woman and her son get the portion? You bet, she gets the portion. So there is careful provision, and that was absolutely radically unheard of for a widow to be taken care of. I'll tell you another thing is the poor. All of these regulations about don't glean the edges of your fields and don't send the reapers back twice and so on, all of those, no, but they had to go out and get it. They couldn't wait for the check at home, you know, but they had to go out, and but it was there for them. This is Ruth, of course, and so many provisions. Listen, in so many ways, the law is so careful, so just. Oh, I could go on and on about it, but I'll tell you one other thing, because it kind of galls me, is there is a number, there is a good deal of legislation about slaves. And the unbelieving world, and sometimes the untutored and careless believing world, are offended. Well, actually, just understand this, that and probably the most offensive is Exodus 21. But I better not go there. I'll lose my way. But in Exodus 21, it says, you know, if you beat your slave and he dies, then you're guilty. It's manslaughter. But if he lasts a couple days, then it's okay. And it seems like, what in the world is that all about? Well, number one, the Jews were not allowed to have slaves of one another. Now, there were Gentiles who became, if you don't mind, slaves. Listen, time out. I have my own personal, I have a lot of them, I guess, but because when we think about slaves, we immediately think of the wickedness of our colonial days and all that sort of thing. It's a very, very different system. Almost all the slaves, I mean, the great portion of passages that talk about slaves is talking about indenturement. And the problem is, if I owe David some money and I can't pay it and I don't pay it, he can take me to court and the judge can decide for, in order to repay that, I owe him $1,000 and I'm worth $250 a year. Well, then I got to work for 4 years. And I'm his indentured slave. Now, almost all of the regulations are placed upon him, the owner, how he has to treat me, how he has to care for me. In Exodus 21, there's a famous passage where it says, if the Sabbath year comes and the slave came into you single and you gave him a wife, and when Sabbath year comes, Sabbath year is when they debts are suspended, and so he can go out and find a job, but the master keeps the slave. And, well, how wicked is that? The poor guy, you get this picture of him wandering off and the kids in the back because he's going off. No, the whole point is that the master has to care for his family. He gave him his family, and the guy, poor guy's trying to make some money so he can work himself out of indenturement. So on a Sabbath year, you got to care for the family. And is really kind and careful to the, but quite frankly, and now you're going to disagree with me, but that's all right. I'm big enough to handle it. But, you know, this whole business of, look, let me go back to my illustration. So I'm indebted. I can't pay it. I don't pay it. It's quite clear I'm kind of a sloth, okay? I'm not the hardest working guy. I've been careless and so on, but now I owe him. Well, I'm a piece of property. I mean, I'm more than that, and he has to treat me as more than that, but he is an investment in me. So, you know, I like to sleep late. Well, say what you will. A couple of bamboo rods across my behind would probably convince me that that's not a wise thing to do. I'm not convinced that there is intrinsic wickedness in physical punishment, let's put it that way. And it was all very carefully, you know, it had to be humane and so on. But I always say we're so offended by that, see, in the Bible there is no, Egypt had a prison, Rome had prisons, so on, but there's no, you know, law where it says he goes to jail for so many years. The punishments in the Bible are either fines or beatings or execution. And I don't know. I think it would probably straighten some things out, but I can't say that in public. But do what you will with that. By the way, I want to say one other thing with regard to Lex Talionis. I forgot it. I'll come back. And that is this, that, you know, it says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And it's kind of curious because the Jewish rabbis in the Talmud discuss this a great deal. And one of their questions is, how obligated are we to be literal? So if you put out my eye, do I have to put out your eye? And they always said, no, that's not what God intends. And I think they're right. And the reasoning is this. They say, well, if I put your tooth out, and so the judge says, well, then you have to put one of my teeth out. So the guy is trying to do it, and he accidentally knocks two teeth out. So now we got to knock his, and he says, pretty soon we'll have a village full of toothless men. That's what it says. So the point is, they understood appropriate fines and so on, but the punishment ought to match. That's bottomlessly wise and equitable. Now, going back to it, even with the slaves. Curious thing about slavery is this, and I'm going to wander here for just a minute, but you know, and this really speaks to what we're talking about here. Israel was to be a light to the nations, and thousands and thousands of people, of Gentiles, were attracted and gave their allegiance to Yahweh and made themselves part of Israel, moved to Israel, Ruth. But there was a problem. How are they going to live? Because you see, they could never own land. Why? Because the land had been entirely divided up and given to the Jews. Now, they could, under certain circumstances, maybe rent land until the year of Jubilee or whatever, but they couldn't own land. And so they had to figure out ways. And it's so intriguing to me to find in the Old Testament, and there are a lot of them when you start looking a little closer, Gentiles who had to get, remember Moses' father-in-law Jethro, the Midianite? Now, I won't walk you through it, but you know what he did? He became an ironsmith, or at least his descendants they had a guild, an ironsmith guild. And they would travel from place to place. Now, you got to put a lot of scriptures together, and so maybe I'm adding 2 and 2 and getting 22. But I think I can build the case that that's what you did. But again and again, you have this way. And one of the ways you might contrive to move to Israel and live is to become somebody's personal servant. And you would indenture bore the ear. And you would... What is it?
Oh, I didn't have a term.
There's a term for it. Why can't I say that term? But basically, you would become their willing servant. And by the way, generally, that servant in time would be made part of the family. As a matter of fact, and this is more Roman than Jewish, but it's reflected in Jewish culture as well, if you had a slave and you usually had a contract, and he would work off his indenturement or whatever after so much, and then you would make him a part of the family. But what you would call him is, do you know, a friend. Hitherto I have called you servants, now I will call you a friend. That's the slave, the indentures. But my point is simply this, that the whole system of slavery, and I started to say earlier, it's too bad that when we think of slavery, we think all that is odious, and some people have preached that, well, you know what it is to be a slave. You don't think for yourself. You have no will. You know, that's not the biblical picture. As a matter of fact, many of the slaves were given really responsible positions. And so I leave it alone. My point is that, matter of fact, let me go back to it. Now I'm in deep trouble, but I'm going to be quick. So God puts Israel in a place, but then he gives them this law code, which though they were never as faithful as God, I mean, they were so haltingly faithful to it, but even to this day, folks, even to this day, the Jewish people are colored by their allegiance to some of those laws, many of which are Mosaic ramifications that aren't real close, like the, you know why they wear the earlocks? Because Moses said, nobody knows for sure, I don't think, what he said, don't cut the corners of your beard. I don't know what it was. That's how they take it. Certainly nothing moral. I think it's okay to cut the corners of your beard. But it was to make them distinctive. So to this day, it's that law which and it makes them distinctive, but it also it was attractive because it of its equity, its justice. That makes sense to you? All right. I'm going to do this real quickly. Regular rainfall, rapid runoff, and God's requirement of rain. Let me just take you to the passage. It's Deuteronomy chapter 11. And again, all of this is of a piece. Because in Deuteronomy 11, you have this, and we've talked about this, so I can be quick. He says in verse 10, and again, this is Moses, his last sermons before he turns it over to Joshua and they cross the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. And he says, the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed and watered it by foot. And there are all sorts of explanations of what it means by water by foot. I think it may just mean carry a pail, for heaven's sake. But however you like it, you could have a garden anywhere because it was the Nile River. You get you some water and irrigate anything. So he says, the land which you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys. Now, I showed you pictures. Hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain. They get plenty of rain, but it just soaks it up. A land for which the Lord your God cares. And then he says, the eyes of the Lord your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. Now, what he means by that is, this is not a land where 1 year's rain will help you the next year. The water runs off. And then he goes on to say this. It shall be that if you earnestly obey my commands, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God, serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land, the early rain and the latter rain. Now, are you familiar with what this is going on here? Israel, real quickly, for 6 months of the year, I told you this, they get the weather off the Arabian Desert. Then for that's the hot, dry season in the summer. It doesn't rain. It flat doesn't rain. Then for 6 months, they get all their weather off the Mediterranean Sea. That's the winter rainy season. Now, they have a very short growing season for grain. That's the winter. They plant the grain in the fall. They harvest it in the spring and summer. Now, during the summer, the earth, you know, it's very hot sun, up early, very steady sun, and it just bakes the earth. And so now comes the fall when you want to plant your grain, but you can't even get a plow in the ground until you get what is called the former, or here the early rains. Because by reason of the way God crafted that part of the world, there is some huge meteorological phenomena that happens right at the end of October, and the winds shift and you get a dumping of rain. It's called the early rain. And you desperately need that early rain just to get the plow in the ground. Then you plant your grain and you nurture it and you pray for rain. But because the season is so short, you really need the latter rain to set the grain. So you hear what God is saying? If you obey me, I'll give you the former and the latter rains, and guess what? You'll have grain to eat. Now, in the summer, by the way, you grow the hillside crops, olives, grapes, pomegranates, figs, and those, though you get no rain in the summer, almost 75% of the nights you get in 75% of the land you reach dew point. So you have a heavy dew. It's a heavy dew. And they can survive on that, but only if God gives it. And he goes on to say, so this is what I'm saying to you, that in a really dramatic way, God crafted that land in such a way ecologically, that he kind of had a short leash around Israel's neck, and he could give it a jerk when he had to. Because if you didn't get the former and latter rains, it's going to be a tough year. And he says, if you obey, then I'll send you the former and latter rains. So, one more, that's what I'm saying here. This is the distinct season. And then finally is the cycle of calendar, climate, crops, and celebrations. Now, I give you this on page 4, but let me just say it real quickly because we're going to be done. There are 7 Levitical feasts which God imposed on Israel. God made their yearly calendar. In Leviticus 23, he lays out 7 Levitical feasts. There are other feasts, Purim and so on, and even But these are the seven Levitical feasts. They are really grouped 3-1-3. So in the spring, you have three feasts. In the summer, you have one feast. And then in this fall, you have three more feasts. Now, the primary feast in the spring is Passover. And the feast that stands alone in the summer is Pentecost. And the feast that the primary feast in the, for our purposes here, in the fall is Tabernacles. Now, here's what I want you to see. Each one of those feasts has a very important agricultural component. Because you see, in the spring, when you celebrate Passover, you also celebrate first fruits. First fruits is in celebration of the early grain harvest, which is barley. So, and it's quite simple, but you take a sheaf, a good sheaf, you go out and the grain's coming in and it's late winter, early spring, and it's about time for harvest, and so you go out and the early grain is barley. And you take a sheaf of that, and there are different explanations exactly how it was done, but basically you take that and you wave it before the Lord and you're acknowledging this is because of your goodness. And then you have Passover. 50 days later, you have the Feast of Pentecost. Pentecost is explicitly the celebration of the wheat harvest. So you have these two late spring, early summer feasts, first fruits, which is connected to Passover. It's part of the week. Actually, it's the main feast. Actually, Passover is not a feast. It's a meal, but it happens at first fruits. And first fruits, you're celebrating God's giving you the barley, and then a few weeks later, you stop everything you're doing and acknowledge that God gives you the grain harvest, the wheat harvest. That makes sense to you? All summer long, you're working on those hillside crops. And then you harvest those, a time of great rejoicing in the fall. And then you have what's called the Feast of Tabernacle or Booths. And the reason it has nothing to do with the tabernacle they built in the wilderness, it's all about you build a little booth, a little sukkah in your backyard. And for 7 days, you take your meals under that sukkah, and they love it. This is their favorite feast of the year. Oh, how they love tabernacles to this day. And every one of those tabernacles, you can go down to Walmart, they tell me, I've never done it, in a Jewish community, and buy a sukkah kit. And it'll have a little thing you can set up in the yard and so on. But there will be, in a little package, there will be some tendrils of vines and figs and so on. And you hang that on there because in the Old Testament, the picture of the kingdom is every man under his vine and his fig tree. Remember that? Now, the point is that you, for a week, you celebrate the harvest of the hillside crops. Now, think about what's at stake here. And I'm trying to say, this is the way God contrived to make Israel a light to the nation. Some of it had to do with the way he shaped the earth, and the other had to do with keeping Israel in line. And so God gave them a calendar where, think about this. This is a healthy thing. We don't do this. Three times a year, you pretty much stopped everything you were doing and spent time acknowledging that God and God alone can give you the grain that you need to live. And if grain is necessary for living the winter crop, then the summer crop is really necessary to enjoy living. The grapes gave them almost all the sweetness in their diet. They used everything, had grapes in it and so on. The olive was their buffalo, if you don't mind. They got so much out of it. They used it for cosmetics. They used it for healing. They used it for light. If you didn't have a good olive crop, you're going to be stubbing your toes all winter long because... Yeah, so the point is that so much of the scent and so on, I like to tell people that there are two elements of life that are very familiar, very accessible and so on, which were very rare in antiquity, and they are color and scent, bright colors and delightful scents. And so the scents that you could get out of those, S-C-E-N-T-S, that you could get out of those hillside crops, so think about the wisdom of this. Three times a year, you pretty much stopped everything you were doing, and you acknowledged that God and God alone can give you life, because without the grain, you can't live. And then you stop and acknowledge that God and God alone can give you the capacity to enjoy life. All of that is very deliberate. I'd love to take you to Ecclesiastes 5 because I think Solomon celebrates that idea. But I'll leave that alone. We got to be done. So now I've got one more. I won't spend any time with it. And that is the struggle for the soul and soil. Very simply, the point is simply this, that Israel, God made a covenant with Israel by which he would be their people and he would put himself on display to the world, to a world that despises Yahweh. And as I said to you before, is the Tevye dynamic, this is not an easy assignment. And so it's always been the tendency of Israel. On the one hand, there's been a struggle for the soil because Israel is so hated to this day. Folks, you cannot make any sense. I don't know if you can make any meaningful sense at all, but you can't make any sort of sense of the insane, wicked hatred that people have impulsively for Israel. The fact that in our culture today, we can make no moral distinction between the determination of Israel's enemies to slaughter Israeli children and the determination of Israel to protect her children. Those are all morally equivalent. That's morally insane. How do you explain that? You've got to insinuate this spiritual reality, that people, haltingly, reluctantly, but necessarily, represent God on the face of this earth. And you know, I believe, and I think this is the point of 1 Peter 2:9, that Israel has been set aside as the primary means by which God has put himself on display, and God has raised up the local church, this body right here in this place, and we have that obligation today. But God is not through speaking through Israel. I mean, today, the very fact that she is there is God screaming at the top of his lungs, I am a God who keeps covenant. And it drives the unbelieving world crazy because they hate the God whom that nation, albeit reluctantly and haltingly, represents. That make sense to you? So there's always going to be a struggle for the soil. And then in the heart of the Israeli himself, there's always this struggle of how do we react to this? Maybe if we just kind of look a little less Jewish. Maybe if we abandon some of this. Maybe if we embrace things. And I always say the really unfortunate mistake of the Jewish people again and again is to fall prey to the notion that the world hates them because they act Jewish. They hate them because they are Jewish. And so there is this, on the one hand, this is Pharisee and Sadducee. It is exactly, today it's secular Jew, religious Jew. They hate each other's guts because they're struggling over the soul of Israel. How do we survive? Do we assimilate? Do we look more Gentile and less Jewish? Or should we just commit ourselves to trusting God and doing what he demands of us and so on? That was the Pharisees and the Sadducees in the first century, and I'm telling you, the more things change, the more they stay the same because it's exactly the same today. All right, I'll leave it alone at this, but let's just rehearse it. And this is, tomorrow night we're gonna do something very different. We're going to go to the new covenant and so on. But just think about, let this settle in for just a minute. I would argue that at least in these seven ways, or these are seven concepts which are helpful to understand the distinctiveness of what God is doing in the Old Testament. God's intent was always that Israel would be a light, and to that end, he shaped the world in such a way that where they were would ensure that all the nations of the world would hear the stories of what Yahweh was doing on behalf of his people. But he shaped that little tiny land so they could live in remarkable seclusion and be a holy nation, a set-apart nation. And then he gave them this law system, which even haltingly obeyed would make them so distinctive and attractive to the rest of the world. They couldn't help but say, what people is there that has laws so wise as these people? And then he crafted their ecology so that they were desperately dependent upon the former and latter rains that only he could give, so he could draw them up short again and again. And then he gave them this religious calendar by which they as a people would stop again and again and acknowledge that he and he alone could give them both life and the capacity to enjoy life. And he's doing all that through a people, regardless of how many of them are believers. That make sense to you? All right, we're going to contrast that. All right, I hope that's some help. Let's have a word of prayer. Thank you for your patience. Father, again, we worship you we honor you for your wisdom. And thank you, Father, for this marvelous record that you've given. You intervened, you intersected human history and wrought mightily, and then you raised up spokesmen to write it down for us and to explain it to us. And now we have this marvelous record, both Old and New Testament, of what you have wrought in human history and what you intended to accomplish and will accomplish through those interventions. Thank you for that. Thank you. We thank you for the people of Israel. We thank you that they have paid an awful price, often reluctantly, but they've paid an awful price for bearing the testimony of who you are to the world. We thank you that it was through them that we received the scriptures and now Messiah. And we pray for the people of Israel. We pray for the little land of Israel. And I'd pray both for that land and then for the testimony, and that we might be effective in exciting jealousy for the gospel in the hearts of those about us. First of all, Jews, and then all those about us. But then, Father, we thank you that you have, in fact, accomplished your purposes in times past, and we take that as Ebenezer, and we look forward to what you are yet to do in the coming year, Son. So thank you for the time together now. In Christ's name, amen. All right.